Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony. You are listening to episode 202, and we are very, very happy to have with us for this episode someone that we had on the show almost 100 episodes ago, so it's been a long time coming. It's everybody's favorite local Toronto star, the one and only, the very talented Mr. Adam Gorham. Adam, thank you for coming to the show. How is it going?
Oh, thank you for having me. It's going okay, all things considered.
That's good. I ask everybody this, and it's I think an essential question to start conversation these days, but how has your 2020 been with all of the madness and the twilight zone that we seem to be living in right now?
It's probably better than most, but it's pretty heavy. If we're being serious, there's a lot of heavy stuff to deal with, and I've been doing the best I can, and I've been fortunate to have work in front of me. I've been doing okay. I guess I can't really complain, but in the dialogue that we're having, everybody seems to be pinning the blame on the year itself, 2020. And
yeah.
So if that's the case, this year is really, really sticking it to us on every conceivable level. So, it's weird. Like I keep thinking about the world, the state of the world when this is over. I think we all kind of, even if we can't really see a light at the end of the tunnel, we're thinking about it, we're picturing it. And, it's funny to think that it's June now. It's like we're into the middle of the year.
Yeah.
And so, many problems that we thought would, depending on who you listened to, what you may have thought, what information we had or whatever, we thought that we would be inconvenienced for a couple of weeks to a month. Yeah. And, our whole way of life has changed. And, I think that pressure is putting, pressure on a lot of other facets of contemporary society. And, so we're seeing effects that we hadn't really anticipated. It's a wild time, to say the least, and I'm doing okay.
Absolutely. That's the thing, right, is that everybody has stuff to express about this right now, because this is, everyone has different circumstances. I know for a lot of artists, working alone in their home is, or in their studio, wherever they might go to work, is the norm, right? Like, they've kind of been trained for being creative and productive isolated, in a way, right? But it's still, you look outside the window, you watch the news, and those things that you do on a daily basis to, get back out there and do your normal stuff, you're got this sense of paranoia, and it's shared around the world. It's not just one country, one city. This is global. So it's we all have got stuff that we need to share and talk about. But it's good that you've been busy, that you've been working, and some of us do have it a little bit, I hate saying better than others, but we need to be grateful for our blessings, right? At the same time, because some people do have it really rough right now. So it's important to be grateful and to be gracious to other people in this time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then you top it all off with the civil unrest that occurred. You're like, what else do you want us to deal with in this half year? It's like the longest year it seems so fast. So yeah, it's a lot, but good that you're doing well. I really enjoyed your donations that you did for the Black Lives Matter, those sketches that you did. That was really dope. Good on you, man.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, to be clear, it was other people making the donations.
Your creative donation, that's what I meant.
Yeah, I would hate to take credit for anybody else's donation, I still have more to do. I had to set them aside temporarily to meet some deadlines, but I'll be getting back to those within a week or so, and hopefully being in a place where I can, you know, open up to do more. And because, you know, there's, as we see, there's still, you know, that civil unrest, as you mentioned, like, it's still very much going on. And I believe that we're in it for the long haul. And, you know, so I just, if it's, you know, I can only donate so much myself personally. And I, you know, I can only, you know, I'm just a small voice, but, you know, me, and I'm happy to say, like, a lot of my colleagues that I know are doing what we can for something that I think is very important and bigger than all of us. So
absolutely,
you know, it's been, again, just a wild time.
Yeah, and it takes all of us, right? Everyone needs to contribute a little bit for there to be that big effect. You might not, you know, build the entire wall, but we all put bricks on it, and that's what matters. So it's not who's doing the most, it's all of us doing something. So
yeah, that's a very nice way of putting it.
Yeah, and to see all of the support, you know, it sounds like a dirty way of saying it, but I'm happy that this is finally trending in the right direction and everybody is supporting each other.
Like, yeah, I mean, I'd like to believe that these are the growing pains towards, you know, a better society. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's hope that's the case.
Yeah, for sure. Has your scheduling at all been affected by all of the different shutdowns? Like, as far as, you know, some people said pens down sort of thing, that things weren't going to be happening according to schedule. Have you been affected at all, or are you still good?
No, I've certainly been affected. I was actually one of, you know, working for Valiant. Valiant was the first, if not one of the first publishers to issue a pencils down order. And so, you know, I've been working on a series for them. And, you know, in March I was told, you know, as we saw the pandemic just continue to intensify, I was told early on, pencils down. And, I try to have a couple of things on the go, so I was, you know, fortunate that I could kind of, you know, lean into other things for the time being. But, you know, I think that, again, like with the pandemic, I there was, you know, a time where it was easy to think that this could go away within a couple of weeks to a month. You know, yeah. Like, I think that's what everybody was secretly hoping for.
Yeah.
But, or not even secretly, but I mean, that's just, you know, nobody wants to shut down all of society or, you know, the way of life. So anyhow, you know, I kind of thought that Valiant was a small enough publisher that it could keep going, but, you know, in a way, because they are smaller, they're more vulnerable to big fluctuations in the market. And I think they ultimately did the right thing. And they did it, you know, pretty swiftly. And, you know, I like everybody at Valiant, and know that they're, you know, good people just trying to make good comics. And, you know, but by, you know, also by doing right with everybody on staff and their creative talent. So I think they saw that this was, you know, the best move for everybody. But, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I thought, you know, every time I thought, like, well, this is obviously a little more secure, that wasn't the case. So really, like, nobody's been immune to this, certainly not myself. But I, again, like, I've been lucky in that, you know, after about a month, I was, you know, I was slated to do some work on the Ninja Turtles. So after about a month, I went back to work on that, and I just completed that project. So, you know, I've been fortunate that, if anything, the pandemic has kind of eased my schedule a little bit. You know, I'm not drawing two books simultaneously.
Right.
So I've been able to do all, you know, I have a lot of work, but I've been able to do it as probably more of a relaxed pace than I thought I would have been going into 2020. So, and, you know, and everybody that I work with, they're dealing with the same things. So everybody's very understanding of you know, the situation we're all facing. So, you know, trying to stick to a schedule, trying to be, you know, meet your deadlines and stuff. It's all very tricky, and everybody's understanding. So I think that's, you know, we'll see, you know, we'll see comics, you know, slowly find its feet again, as books kind of like lumber back into being.
Yeah. I think when this is, you know, comes all back around and we get some sort of a semblance of normalcy again.
Hello,
can you hear me? Hello?
Oh, you cut out a couple of times.
Oh, okay. Stay tuned, everybody. This happens when we do online recording. So stay with us. We're not cut out. I was just gonna say, it's gonna be interesting when everything kind of goes back to a new normal, I guess you could say, seeing how the good that came out of sort of this slowdown in pace of everybody's life, for them to kind of catch up and catch their breath and even just rejuvenate their creative forces, to see what it is that people did create during this time, right? Because like you said, that rush of having to do something under a deadline, sometimes that's inspiring for some people, but for others it may make them have to kind of cheat their work a little bit to get things done. So we might see on the other end that excitement come back for comic cons, for going to comic shops, and the work that will come out will be interesting to see what it was that people were doing during this time. So, you know, we got to try to find the silver lining in it all. I think it's going to be okay. I think we'll be all right.
Well, I hope so, you know.
Yeah. What project were you working for at Valiant? It was Punk Mambo, if I remember correctly.
That's correct. I was working on a second volume of Punk Mambo. So Colin Bunn had returned to write. Jose Villaruba was back coloring. So the same team as the first volume. So we were just continuing the story that we told in our first book, and going, you know, more going delving back into the character's history. So it was. It'll be exciting to pick that up again when I do get back to it.
Right. Tell me about working for Valiant, because I'm a big fan of Valiant Comics. I've spoken to Matthew Klein a few times, and it just seems like a very well-run company. I'm not sure what it's like now with, you know, the change in management and things like that, but they just seem to have their finger on the pulse with a sense of confidence in their product. What's it like working there?
It's nice. There's, you know, they're a smaller outfit than other publishers, and so you're able to get to be very familiar with everybody there, you know, that everybody who comes into Valiant, you know, they are very positive about their line, their characters, their brand, and as a creator, they get me excited about doing the work there, and you know, they're very receptive to my needs as a freelancer. One of the reasons why I love doing work at Valiant is that they, you know, they just genuinely seem to be thrilled to have me, which, you know, when your publisher and your editor and everybody else that you're involved with is just, you know, happy that you're there, like they're able to get better work out of me with that support and encouragement. So I'm always very happy. Pardon me. I'm always very happy working at Valiant, and I'm always happy with my work at Valiant. And that's not, you know, not to forget the fans either. Like, Valiant is one of the few places that has this really, you know, dyed in the wool. Valiant fans have been some of the nicest and supportive people that I've come to meet in comics. So that is certainly an added bonus to doing work there. You get to, you know, feel the love from people who truly love the books that are being put out from that publisher. But yeah, they're, you know, like they're small enough to, when you say, you know, well-oiled machine, it's funny because, you know, like they're small enough to make necessary moves really quickly when they have to. You know, they plan, as a publisher, you have to plan out far in advance. I think that they are, you know, really good at, you know, playing within their reach. They try to tell the stories they can tell with, you know, in the timeline that they can tell them, because, you know, they only put out so many books a month, and you know, I think they never try to, you know, their reach never exceeds their grasp in that sense. So I think they handle themselves pretty smartly.
Yeah. And everything so far, I mean, I've read a lot from the new era of Valiant, and it's I can't help but say that it's just been stellar line wide. Like, there hasn't been a book that isn't either good to great. And it's
Right.
hard to say that about a lot of publishing companies when you can pretty much pick up any book off of the shelf with their imprint and it's going to be top-notch quality. And I just, it kind of frustrates me a little bit because I'm like, more people should be reading this. It should have a bigger section in the comic book shop because people always complain about what's wrong with comics, but they're doing a lot of things right. So it's good to hear that creators are also enjoying working there as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, they, you know, I guess if you put out a lot of books, like, you know, I don't think there's a creative team on earth that ever tries to put out a bad book, you know what
Absolutely
I mean? So if
not.
You're one of, you know, if, like, if you're one of the big two publishers or anybody in between, you know, everybody's trying to put out the best possible book, but, you know, it's just kind of like the odds is that not every book will be as stellar as the next when you're putting out 30 to 50 books a month, you know, like it's
True.
Just impossible. You're going to have, there's going to be a relative quality to every title, and that's not really the fault of anybody's, but I think that because Valiant's line is far more concentrated,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, it kind of guarantees, if you're a Valiant reader, it kind of guarantees a higher success rate for pleasing the average Valiant reader. So I think they recognize that. I certainly know that they try to make every book they do the best possible book they can.
Mm-hmm.
They have some really exciting people at the helm now. My editor on Punk Mambo, Lisa Hawkins, who's just tremendous, as well as, you know, Heather Antos. You know, they're both veterans in the industry who are going out of their way to find unique voices, exciting talents, to put together great comics, and so I'm really proud to be working with them.
Yeah. But how long will Punk Mambo be running for? Is it a limited series, or is it to be decided?
It's limited. It's, you know, we'll be doing another 5-issue miniseries.
Okay.
My understanding is that it could be coming out over, you know, winter, like the back end of this year.
Okay.
And that was my last understanding, and yeah, as we know with the times, that could change. But that's what I have planned.
Okay. And for those who have never read Punk Mambo, why should they go and pick up this series, the first and the second volume that's going to be coming?
Why should they?
Yeah.
Well, I think I draw the first series particularly well. You know, Colin Bunn, who is you know, just a really skilled horror writer,
mm-hmm.
and gothic writer. You know, he brings that flavor to this book. Punk Mambo is kind of Valiant's answer to John Constantine. You know, it's supernatural. It's you know, she's also Cockney. She's a punk in the literal sense of the word. And she has these supernatural abilities, and, you know, lives in the world of the occult. So, you know, you have a character that's, you know, cynical and you know, has attitude, and is an anti-hero. So, you know, you, in a way, you kind of know what you're getting into with that, but it has its own stuff going on. And you know, it's a book that plays, the first book played a lot with Haitian mythology. Voodoo mythology, I should say.
Okay.
And you know, I think it was pretty fun. And in this book, we'll be seeing more of her, you know, 70s punk roots in London. And, you know, so I personally think that it's worth your while if you happen to like gothic supernatural horror comics within the superhero, within the realm of a superhero universe.
All right. Well, there you heard it first from the source itself. It's well drawn, well written, and if that's what you're looking for, you can't go wrong. And it's Valiant, so try to check it out. As far as TMNT is concerned, you said you're working on the annual for that. Tell me about that. How's that coming along? When will it be coming out, hitting stores, and what's that process like?
I'm finished the annual now, so the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2020 Annual will be out in July, as far as I understand it. And, you know, not long ago, last year, I think it was last year, my sense of time is a little screwed, but, you know, not long ago, the Ninja Turtles reached their, you know, 100th issue milestone. And, in a big story arc called City at War. And so, you know, that was a very, you know, it was a milestone issue. It was a big change in status quo. You know, we've seen in that issue, you see the return of Shredder back from hell. Master Splinter is, you know, no longer with us. And the fate of the Turtles, you know, the direction they're going into, that they're going into after saving New York is, you know, is something that's being explored right now. So, you know, it's kind of, if you want to think of issue TMNT 100 as a big season finale of sorts, this annual picks up some of the pieces that were, you know, left from that issue. So the main Turtles title right now is following, you know, the main characters. So, but there are other characters that aren't being dealt with in that book. So this kind of addresses some loose ends from issue 100. Specifically, you know, Shredder, Rat King, and Leatherhead, who's been bonded to Krang. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in there, and it's setting up things for future events. So it's a big issue, 30 pages, and I'm very happy with the work that I did on it. You know, the people at Turtles are, you know, have always been really nice and supportive, and they're people who really get their universe. And you know, just speaking of well-oiled machines, there's somebody, you know, like Bobby Crenna, who's the editor there, Tom Waltz writing. Mm-hmm. They have a firm grasp on their characters and on the stories that they're telling, both in the short term and in the long term, as we've seen with issue 100. So, you know, getting to contribute to this tapestry, it's always a privilege. So yeah, I'm excited for people to see it. I've heard nothing but really nice things from Turtles fans regarding my work that I've done on the characters so far, on the book so far. Like I, a couple of years ago, I did a 2-issue arc for TMNT Universe. I've done covers for Turtles here and there, and you know, every time I do something with the Turtles, it's been nothing but positivity. So I'm always excited to return to those characters. So the book's a big one. It's colored by John Roche, or John Rock. But he, you know, he's a wonderful colorist. This is my first time getting to work with him. Probably not the last. And I've seen some of the work that he's turned in so far, and it's truly wonderful. So I'm very excited for people to see it.
That's great. It's so nice when you hear how excited the creators are themselves in the work that they put out, because you're never sure, right, when what the response is going to be, especially for something that's as beloved as the Ninja Turtles are for different generations for different reasons. So to hear your confidence, that's exciting to look forward to that book. Did you grow up watching the Turtles? I'm not sure how old you are. I think we're around the same age, but I know, like, I was a big Ninja Turtles fan every day was watching it.
Yeah, I was born in 1985, so okay. The Turtles were, you know, they were kind of on the rise as I was growing up, and so I was able to enjoy the Turtles at, like, the height of their popularity, you know, when they had the live-action movies coming out, mm-hmm. the animated series, they had, you know, many of the action figures, so I was a big Turtles fan, you know, for me personally, they kind of went away for a little bit. When I was working on a 2-issue story in TMNT Universe Ryan Ferrier, you know, it was, it gave me the opportunity to rediscover my love of the Turtles, and, you know, I brought a lot back. There's, you know, it was a big nostalgia trip. I put on some of the old cartoon episodes and, some of the old movies, and that was super cool and kind of reignited my interest in the Turtles. And, you know, there's a few people that I know who have been following with the series since IDW started it. And, you know, they you know, just speaking with people who love the book also got me really excited about the book, because the mythology that has been built is so rich. And, you know, when you can see a property excite readers when they're invested in it and they are talking about characters and stories from a place of love, like, that type of thing is infectious. So
yeah,
that's something that really struck me early on with doing work on the Turtles, and it's with me still. And so yeah, I was a fan, you know, of the Turtles. I'm probably, you know, even more of a fan now that I can appreciate them beyond like wanting their toys and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. I was really impressed, actually. I started reading the series, the Tom Watts written series that they did at IDW, and I was really impressed with how good that universe was. In many ways, I preferred it to what they put out in the recent movies. I was a little disappointed with that because of how good the books were. So I haven't kept up with it up to issue 100, but what I did read... I think it was the first 8 or so trades. It was stellar. And
I'm sorry if I spoiled anything for you.
No. No problem at all. I mean, it's more other people might be like, "Hey, you spoiled it for me." Not a problem for me. But what I was saying was that when a book goes to issue 100, especially nowadays, when the shelf life of one, people's attention, and also their interest in a book, it rarely goes past 25 issues, 30 if you're lucky. So for it to be at issue 100 and still going, that says a lot about the value of that story and that, it's, like you said, right, that office working on it.
Absolutely. It's a huge milestone. It's a testament to the quality of the book that's being made. It's a testament to the people working on it that really care about it. You know, like, it also, you know, like, it certainly capitalizes on the fact that the, you know, everybody at one point, you know, certainly, you know, aware of the Ninja Turtles, yeah. But also I think a lot of the people reading it now are people like myself who were inundated with the Ninja Turtles growing up, and I think, you know, they have loved the Turtles long enough that they're being rewarded with a book that's well made, stories that are well told. You know, and it's easy to kind of it's easy to invest in properties that seem like it really cares about, you know, the readership. I don't think the Turtles book ever felt like something that was just being churned out because it's a known quantity.
Right.
It was people who were excited about the characters who wanted to build on what people already loved, and it seems that they've done that. So, you know,
yeah,
freaking good for them.
Yeah, definitely. You know, Netflix recently put up all the original Turtles movies on their
yes,
Twitter, and I watched with my wife the original, and you know what, it's a great movie. That first Ninja Turtles movie, it's a great comic book adaptation. I stand by that. It might be hyperbole, those suits might look funny, but I think it's a great Ninja Turtles. I think it's a great movie, especially from the 90s.
I recently watched the second one.
Yeah.
I noticed that it was on Netflix. I put it on for kicks.
Yeah.
And it's I think the second one, I didn't realize it then, but just by comparison, you know, the second one's a lot lighter and goofier. And probably, you know, really embraces its, like, you know, the hokey sci-fi, you know, qualities of the series. And this was, you know, at the height, I think, of the cartoon as well. So, you know, like, I think the second movie better reflected some of the antics from the animated series, but that first movie, you know, was more mature than I probably realized as a kid. Like, I think it just, you know, was filmed, you know, a few shades darker. It seemed a little bit more serious. And I do think it worked. I remember it being a really good one. So I'll have to check it out again.
Yeah, I didn't realize how closely adapted to the comics, like the original comics, it was. Because that was, you know, when you're a kid, you go to the movies, you want the cartoon on the screen, right? And that was very different from how they presented it. But seeing, you know, going back and looking at the original books, I'm like, wow, they really tried to do this justice, and they did a pretty good job considering the times when comic book movies weren't the go-to thing, right? So Yeah, go back and check that out. It was fun. It was a fun movie.
It's definitely on my list, yeah. My ever-growing list of things to pass the time with.
I don't. How old are your kids? Are they able to take in that content, or do you think it would be too mature for them?
Oh no, it's fine for them. Yeah. Like they're 10 and 4 years old. They are both aware of the Ninja Turtles and enjoy the Ninja Turtles. I think my younger one a little bit more so. But I mean, like, you know, I've been working on these books for, almost as long as they've been alive. So a lot of pop, you know, they're inundated with a lot of pop culture anyway.
Yeah.
And, so I think the great thing about the Ninja Turtles is that they kind of have a property for an entry point for any age. So, you know, there's either, you know, the movies that we watch because we're nostalgic for them, or, you know, there's a few animated series that are really terrific for younger audiences. There's the newer movies that I know are not for a lot of people who were fans of the original movies, but, you know, like, again, it's still a gateway.
Right.
And, you know, I'm actually kind of interested in watching the second one because I don't remember it coming out. And I didn't realize that the second one features Krang and the, you know, Technodrome. So, like, that's kind of, I mean, that's what I wanted out of the first movie. So I feel like I have to check that out at some point.
Yeah,
but,
it's fun. It's fun. Yeah, Bebop and Rocksteady are there. Okay. Oh, sorry, did I cut you off? My bad.
Oh, no, that's okay. Oh. It's just like the audio. Sometimes I'll hear only part of a word.
Oh, okay, so there might be a little lag. My bad.
It's okay. We're both trying not to step on each other. We're both being very polite.
We're being very Canadian.
Exactly.
When you do a franchise that is, you know, an established franchise that people have a visual memory for, how much research do you put into understanding the visual language of those characters, especially something like the Ninja Turtles, where if the book isn't colored, you have to have something distinct about those characters to distinguish who they are, because they essentially look the same. There's no real costume to them except for the bandana. So what do you do to, in your style, to distinguish those characters and the weapons? Of course, people are yelling at me, don't forget the weapons, but...
I think that, you know, before I came on, a lot of other artists, like, you know, artists who had previously worked on the book had already done a pretty good job at giving each turtle its own sense of identity outside of its, you know, the color scheme. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a series Bible for, you know, what skin, you know, what tone of green Leonardo's flesh is, what tone of green Raphael's flesh is. Hmm. You know, all of those things are there, but, you know, the next step would be giving them, you know, like certain body shapes, certain proportions, certain facial expressions that you can register as either being Raphael or Michelangelo, Donatello, Leonardo. And I mean, like, I think everybody knows their respective personalities. Michelangelo is obviously kind of a surfer dude, the class clown. So he, you know, it's easy to draw him with like a smile in the corner of his mouth, or just more of a relaxed, a happy expression. Donatello, I always considered to be probably the most earnest of the bunch. So I've, you know, whenever I draw Donatello, I try to draw him with really soulful eyes. Raphael is usually, you know, he's a tough guy. He's broody. Tight shoulders, smaller chest, you know, something to show that, like, it's almost like his personality is a clenched fist, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Then you have Leonardo, who's the leader, who I always thought was, you know, like, Leonardo and Cyclops were always characters where they're the leaders, they're obviously cool because they're the leader. But leaders are also kind of a drag because they ultimately, they got to be they got to enforce the rules. They kind of have to be the stick in the mud. And, you know, they're the teacher on the school bus on a field trip. You know what I mean? So Leonardo is cool, but at the same time, he's kind of like, you know, this stickler older brother, you know.
Yeah.
And he's the one that's turning around and saying, like, let's be serious, guys. And to inject that air into him. And you know, people, a lot of other artists have successfully done that. I try to do it as well.
Yeah.
But I find that it's probably, you know, Raphael's probably one of the more fun ones to draw, because it's just fun to draw brooding looking characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Donatello is always, like I say, you know, like, I like doing portraits, and so there's a little bit more work into, for me anyway, Donatello's expression to convey intelligence, and so I enjoy doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I always wonder that with characters that people have, you know, their definite favorites. You always say, oh, which one's your favorite character of a team, or Ninja Turtles specifically in this case. But then to be able to distinguish them, it's always a real, for me, I'm impressed by how artists are able to convey those things, even if there's no color, because those original books had no color, but you're able to, I guess the weapons are the giveaway, but it's cool to hear you describe it. So you've had the privilege of having collaborated with some great writers. They've had the privilege mm-hmm. of collaborating with you. Al Ewing on Rocket, Ed Brisson on The Valiant, Matthew Rosenberg on New Mutants. But I was asked to get your opinion, and who's your favorite writer that you've worked with and why it's Fred Kennedy?
It's, you know, I love Fred, man. And I think probably the reason why I love working with Fred the most is that he is somebody that just truly wants to collaborate. You know, he's one of the hardest working people I know. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, we've done things where I've given him a bare bones idea and he goes to town doing research.
Yeah.
He goes to town, you know, just reading history books, reading, you know, political science stuff, science stuff. So he, you know, he takes everything to heart. It's his passion for writing is you know, he's a good writer, and his passion for it is just, you know, it's remarkable. So, you know, I think that's probably why I really like collaborating with Fred, is because he makes me feel valuable. He puts together really good ideas, you know, based on very little. He'll run to town with it, man, and just the ideas. Like, he's somebody whose mind is always at work, you know. Mm-hmm. It's always processing stuff. It's always, you know, he's always wondering about this and that. So, you know, and then he kind of filters it through, you know, his story ideas. So, you know, he's somebody who's engaged with the world around him.
Mm-hmm.
He's always trying to better himself, and he's truly empathetic. And so, you know, he tells stories that speak to, you know, his convictions and his punk beliefs, and I think that the quality of his stories, you know, his stories are richer for that. So I can't say enough great things about Fred.
Yeah,
but I've been lucky enough to collaborate with some really exciting writers, and you know, really I've learned something from them all, and they all try to give me their best, and they all try to write with me in mind, and you know, you can't really ask for more than that.
Yeah. I heard Brian Michael Bendis recently say that when he works with an artist, he tries to see what they who they love, what they like working on, and then he'll build a story around what's going to make them happy working on it. Not to say that they can't draw anything, because, you know, as an artist, you're able to, or you should be able to come to the table and deliver whatever's asked, but you get so much more if the writer has you in mind of making this an enjoyable process for you and your storytelling. So that's good that there's that graciousness between you and the writer.
It's you know, like, it can be tricky, because, you know, like, there's writers who I've been excited to work with, and, you know, when you're doing work for higher stuff, especially for a big publisher like Marvel, which is, you know, I got to work with Matt Rosenberg on an X-Men related book, and that was certainly, you know, a bucket list thing, but you're still you know, you're still working within a larger playground. Mm-hmm. And so there are, you know, there are other people's fingerprints on that, and there are rules. And so, you know, like, I can't say that those projects are always the most liberating in terms of creative freedom. Mm-hmm. You do the best you can, both the writer and the artist, but, you know, there's a relative quality to that as well. You know, when I was doing Rocket with Al Ewing, you know, there was kind of, I think, low expectations for Rocket to be an interesting book. And, you know, sometimes when that's the case, you're able to do a lot more with a character because right. there's less red tape around it. And
right.
so I think Al was able to piece, you know, when I came on board Rocket, a lot of this was, you know, Rocket was, you know, largely Al's thing. I felt like it was a world that I got to, you know, play around in. But the, you know, conceptually, like, it was all Al. And, you know, we got more out of that book than I think anybody anticipated. And then, so, you know, you do what you can with while you're able to. But, you know, with Ed, I've got to work on our creator-owned stuff with the violent. We're actually doing another violent book at the moment. Yeah.
That's great.
And so that'll be between Ninja Turtles and you know, whenever I return to my Valiant work, Ed and I will be doing another creator-owned book. And so, you know, like, in those terms, like, Ed's, you know, like, Ed's a great writer. I've enjoyed the stuff that he's been doing at Marvel. You know, the stuff of his that I've read, like his recent Ghostwriter book has been a lot of fun. His, you know, X-Force book with Dylan Burnett was a lot of fun. I got to work with him briefly on a miniseries back in October called Contagion. And, you know, again, like, Ed's dope, so, but, like, you know, it's easy to see where somebody's passions lie. Mm-hmm. Ed's, you know, a big crime guy, and he, you know, just listening to him talk about what he's writing now, because he's writing it for himself, he's writing it, you know, for me, and just the level of passion and joy that's going into the work, again, kind of makes me, I feed off of that. So doing this work with him now is pretty crazy. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, that's great. Will the Violent be picking up where the last characters left off, or is it going to be a new group of characters that you're going to be telling a story about?
When Ed and I started The Violent, it was always intended to be an anthology-style book set within contemporary Canada. You know, at the time when we created The Violent, Ed was living out in BC, and the book addressed a lot of what was going on in British Columbia at the time, and still is. And so we wanted to tell, you know, very grounded human crime stories set within the world that we knew, that we were familiar with. You don't see a lot of stories about Canada from Canadian creators show up in American publishers. So that was something that we really wanted to pioneer at Image. And so the plan was to always do it anthology style. And there might be connective tissue between stories, characters that carry over, minor characters that get a bigger role in later books. So this next book deals with, you know, a character who appeared in the first Violent in their younger days during the 1980s. And
cool.
It's during the 1980s, set against the Satanic Panic, and revolves around you know, a group of kids who run away from home.
Okay, very cool. You know, there, in reading your work from Teuton to Rocket and the Violent, I was going to say Valiant, it's just my bad.
It's okay.
Your adaptation to the type of work you're illustrating, it's pretty awesome, because it's clearly you. Like, you notice a person's work, but just the feel of that era that you're drawing, whether in Teuton it's you know, a bygone era, and then with Rocket in space, you get that sci-fi feel. But with the Violent, these moments that are just taking place inside of someone's house or inside of a hospital room, and the facial expressions that you captured in it were, it's almost like you can get a scent of the room with the way that you illustrated it. How do you, is it just a, an evolution of your work, or is there something that you do specifically to each type of book where you say, how am I going to now adjust what it is that I'm doing for this feel?
You know, every time I approach a new project, I try to be conscious of how I can approach this material, give every project its own identity. I'll try and push myself creatively to maybe draw a little bit different or adapt something, you know, try to basically to challenge myself and keep the work fresh, feeling fresh for me and interesting. And it, you know, like I'll do some research. I will, you know, familiarize myself with the cast of characters, and I'll fill drawings of, you know, I'll fill a sketchbook with drawings of my main characters. I'll think if there's, you know, if there's a layout or a location that we'll see a few times, like I'll try and map that out as best I can so that it feels natural. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's, I always try to start out doing something different. And then I think with comics being the way they are, like when it becomes some, you know, when you're in the thick of things and you need to get stuff done, you know, there's ways that I draw that just rise to the surface regardless. And so, you know, like I find my groove by usually the third issue of a book. And by the third issue, I've really discovered who I am in that series, who I am with these characters. And that's when you really start to see the work come out in a more natural way. And so, you know, with the violent, the locations were a lot more familiar. They were contemporary, so I didn't have to do a ton of research. I could just sort of look to the outside world for all of those reference points. Mm-hmm. And then because the island took place in a lot of real world locations in Vancouver, Google, you know, Maps was certainly very helpful. But you know, with Rocket being sci-fi and taking place in space, I had to imagine all of that. And so I was then looking at different references for not just anything sci-fi, but for the right kind of sci-fi. You know, Rocket is part of, I think, what made Rocket good was that Rocket is sort of seen as a comedic character. I think since Scotty Young's take on the character, Rocket's been kind of, you know, he's had kind of like a, you know, sort of rude, crass sense of humor, and, you know, has been fairly slapstick. And so that's, I think, for most people, their idea of who Rocket is. And so Al intentionally played against type with that by, you know, making Rocket a hard-boiled noir anti-hero in his series. And so it's that play against type kind of made for its own little joke, and the fact that many of the characters were anthropomorphic animals or aliens also kind of, you know, even when the subject matter even if the visuals were darker and if the subject matter could, you know, verge into the more mature, because a lot of the feelings that Rocket was dealing with were heavier, you know, it was still being delivered by, you know, a woman who's an otter or a guy who's a beaver. So, you know, you couldn't escape a certain amount of levity in that book. And because of that, you know, looking at sci-fi properties for inspiration, I leaned into, there's an adaptation of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy from, I think, like the 70s or 80s, but I have, you know, that I watched as a kid. And, you know, it's akin to kind of like the production values of Doctor Who, you know, so you'd have like, you know, cheap looking alien makeup, puppets, props, that kind of thing. And that's what I leaned into when trying to create the world of Rocket. I wasn't trying to make it Star Wars or Blade Runner or anything like that. I was thinking of Hitchhiker's Guide. And I think that it felt a lot more natural with that in mind. And then, you know, like, Even with the Ninja Turtles, you know, it's set in New York, but it's, you know, New York in the city, in a sense, is its own character in that book. It's like, you know, when, you know, everything is gritty in Ninja, in the world of the Ninja Turtles. You know, there's nothing really too polished, and so on. So, you know, again, that was like a version of this world that I felt suited my abilities. But yeah, so I, you know, with properties, I'll do a certain amount of research. I'll try to consider what I'm doing, what the subject matter is, how can I approach it in an interesting way? How can I approach it that, you know, in a way that hasn't been done before? Yeah, that was the case when I was working on New Mutants, and I was tackling characters that were known and beloved. I thought about how I might be able to approach the look and feel for those characters in a way that hadn't been done yet. That was certainly the case with Ilyana Rasputin, Magic, and I was lucky to have a lot of people embrace that. So, you know, I try to bring some flavor to everything that I do, and I think as a result, my body of work is maybe a little varied, but I think ultimately it all ends up looking like me anyway. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you're gonna recognize the work, and that's part of. I think every artist wants their work to be recognizable, but that it's kind of like that Stuart Immonen thing where he's worked on a bunch of different properties, and that ability to adapt to them, depending on what he's working on, is kind of a highlight for how good he is, right? And I think in the work that you've put out so far, there's that familiarity of this is Adam's work, but it's not the same as that other thing he does. There's that little bit of uniqueness to it for the book that you're reading, which is a testament, I think, to the quality. So that's good.
Oh, thing. Well, thank you. I mean, I certainly hope that's how people feel if they come to my work, and you know, I it's very nice to hear. Thank you.
I was in preparation for these episodes. I try to find friends of the people that I'm going to talk to as best as I can to dig up as much dirt to see what I can ask them. So I was told that I need to talk to you about Dune, because apparently you really love Dune. I have the book on my shelf. I haven't read it yet. I always plan to. It's one of those things that I have to read in my lifetime. Tell me why you love Dune so much.
You know, Dune is... to a certain degree, I inherited my love of Dune from my father. My father is a big fan of Frank Herbert's writing. Dune is Frank Herbert's magna opus. Dune was pretty big in my world even before I had read it. I would see, you know, those books on my father's bookshelf. I was very familiar with their spines and the painted covers and
so cool.
And so on. Then eventually when I would come to read Dune... Like, Dune is, in my mind, it's a truly prolific work of science fiction that is just a really different kind of sci-fi, universe than you've seen. And when you read it, you can see how it's inspired many other things, notably, you know, Star Wars.
So
there's so much in, you know, there's so much in Star Wars DNA that comes from Dune. Reading it is cool for that reason, because, you know, you're like, oh, this is clearly, you know, this would clearly be this in Star Wars and so on and so forth. I mean, for those unfamiliar with Dune, like, so, Dune is a name for a planet called Arrakis, which is a desert planet, and it's the only source in the universe for a product called spice. And spice is something that consumed in large qualities can give people the gift of foresight. So not exactly seeing the future, but an ability to kind of forecast the future. And this is important because it allows for interstellar travel. It allows for warp travel. So without the spice, with the spice, human civilization has managed to, you know, conquer the known galaxy, because they're able to, warp into far flung, you know, warp light years away without warping into a planet or a sun or a supernova, that kind of thing. So that's become really important because and the reason why that is the case is because at one point there was humanity had created an AI that enslaved humanity, and that sparked a very long war, you know, humanity against the machines. And so once humanity defeated the artificial intelligence that had enslaved them, it was made a law that basically no machine could be built, no machine that does the thinking of a man could be built and used. So, you know, because the risk of artificial intelligence taking enslaving humanity was far too great. So, you know, they need the spice for interstellar travel. The spice comes from this one planet called Arrakis. And so, you know, it's a highly valuable, highly coveted commodity that pretty much all of civilization depends upon. And so within that world, there's, you know, there's a lot of lessons to be learned. Like, it talks about ecology. It talks about the hazards of relying on one source of energy. Talks about, you know, like, there's environmental stuff that's, like, relevant to this day. And then apart from that, like, just the mythology that it, you know, creates for its universe is really, really striking and interesting. And a lot of it, too, is just, some of it's just so friggin' weird that it, you know, like, it's just, you don't, it's you know, there's a lot of weirdness in the Dune books, especially as you get into the later ones. So all of this stuff is, like, just so up my alley, you know, and so I think the first book is probably the most accessible because it's the most conventional story. You know, you have this, if you're familiar with Game of Thrones, like, Dune deals with this one family house that has, you know, that's, you know, rivals with other family houses, and there's a constant struggle for power and dominion, especially over the spice. So you're seeing this one powerful house fall from grace, and how that house can possibly rise back to power. And so the first book kind of fits those, you know, certain conventions that we've seen before, but they get progressively stranger as they go on. Like, it explores the idea of organized religion and how that can be used to manipulate and control populations. It explores the ideas of how prophets can ultimately be very disappointing, and how, you know, like, prophecies can be self-fulfilling and so on and so forth. So Dune is great because there's a lot of, like, intellectual stuff. There's a lot to chew on. And it's also just, once you get into it, it's a really dense, rich sci-fi world. So I could probably talk a lot more about Dune, but I think I would rather encourage people to read it or just wait for the movie that will be coming out.
Are you excited about that? It looks like the cast looks great for it, as far as the talent in that's casted.
Yeah, like, I really like the director, Denis Villeneuve, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, a Canadian director, which is super cool. You know, he's directed us, I think, all the movies of his that I've seen, I've really, really enjoyed. So, you know, he's a director that I think would probably have a really great handle on the material. You know, he directed Blade Runner 2049, which was probably, like, one of the last big budget R-rated sci-fi movies to come to theaters. And, you know, he had a really masterful control over tone, over the story he was telling, and over his vision for it, that managed to feel a piece of the first Blade Runner. So, you know, he's a director that I would be excited to see what he does with the material. And the cast looks good. Like, it's, you know, a lot of the actors in the movie are familiar to, or at least, you know, Josh Brolin anyway, but, you know, he always assembles a pretty interesting cast, and I'm really glad to see that there is some diversity in the characters that have been cast. So, you know, I'm hoping for it. I'm hoping for it. I've seen some of the photos. I'm intrigued by what I've seen. I really want to see what they do with the sandworms. So, you know, I'm excited.
You got me excited to read this book, actually. I'm going to be honest with you. Because all
Good,
of the,
I'm glad.
All of the themes that you brought up, even in getting into like the books after the fact, are stuff that I enjoy discussing and thinking about. And I love sci-fi. I'm always intimidated by those big, thick novels that feel like this is a whole universe that I've got to figure out. And I sometimes don't even know the Marvel universe the way I'd like to. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to grasp this, but the way you explained it, I'm like, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. I have a really nice bound volume from Barnes & Noble in the States where they put out all these classic novels like Count of Monte Cristo, the Foundation trilogy, and I purchased them all because I said, one, they look great to be on the shelf, but I'd like to read that book. It looks like something special inside of those covers, so I got a great cover, a great bound volume of Doom, so I'm going to definitely read it.
Yes, as you should.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I'm looking forward to all of the work that you've got coming out. I'm happy that you and your family are doing well and staying safe, and hopefully we can talk again soon and see each other at a Comic-Con. That would be really nice to be able to do that.
If that ever happens, it would be a pleasure to see you. But in the meantime, thank you for having me on. It's been really enjoyable getting to talk to you.
Awesome. You have a great rest of the week, and continue to stay safe.
Thank you. You as well. Take care.
Thanks, dude.